This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, tens of thousands of Haitians remain in the streets, protesting yet another rigged election by the foreign occupiers of that country. Tensions increase in Milwaukee between police and the revolutionary Black Panther Party. And after 8 years of Obama, all the hope and change has turned out to be hype and a lower standard of living for Black and poor people.
But first, when Donald Trump said, "Let there be an arms race," it caused quite a stir. However, President Obama has set the U.S. on a course for a unilateral trillion-dollar upgrade of nuclear weapons. We spoke with Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
These statements coming from Trump, which now the media jumps on to show how reckless and dangerous he is, when similar escalations were done in the Obama administration, it passed almost without notice, without publicity. And there were major escalations in U.S. wars abroad and very extremely dangerous nuclear preparation at home. And it really shows that it's the U.S. system. It's the Pentagon as a military institution and corporations that must expand or they suffocate. They must make extraordinary profits or they shrivel up and die. And they'll tell any lie and use any politician in order to carry that out. That means Democrat or Republican, although the media always acts like there's a choice, that there's huge differences. There are policy variations. There are differences in conduct. There are differences in the social base of both political leaders, both forces, and both political parties. But they both carry out the interests of U.S. corporate power. And that has to be understood and explained again and again and again. There's no real and substantial difference between either party, and both are determined to carry out this reaction. Now, the difficulty, there's a lot of deep opposition, understandably and rightfully so, against Trump as a racist bigot, willing to use the most extreme and ugly against LGBTQ people, against immigrants, against Muslims, and racist terminology, and raise it up and repeat it again and again and send it out as tweets. So he has awakened or given new life, let's say, to a completely reactionary social forces in the U.S., where it's become acceptable, whole new layers. And the corporate media thinks that's great. They'll repeat this endlessly. But both systems carry out the same policy, both political parties.
In Syria, the liberation of Aleppo after 4.5 years of occupation by jihadists is all but complete. Syria's biggest city finally no longer under siege, and most folk in the world would say that's a good thing, but it has the leaders of the United States quite upset.
It certainly does. This is a huge, huge setback for U.S. policy, U.S. plans to completely rip Syria apart. And it was an aggressive policy from the very beginning that goes all the way back to Bush's war on Iraq and has continued nonstop. Syria has been under sanctions going back to 1998, and they were intensified in 2003 with the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. And then, of course, we have with the Arab Spring an all-out effort by the Obama administration to use every method of covert operation. All of this has been pushed back. It's not the end of the war, but it's a huge step to pull what is the largest industrial city in Syria and liberated from the hold of completely reactionary jihadist Takfiri, many different terms used, but for a completely reactionary and mercenary forces that had a hold on a section of Aleppo. This means that really of every major city in Syria now, the Syrian government has prevailed. And it has prevailed because there's been such a determination on the part of the Syrian people, and also because there's been real solidarity and concrete assistance from Russia, from Iran, from Hezbollah forces in Lebanon, which Syria had every right to call on, even under international law. So they have stopped an all-out effort to totally destroy Syria. There's still a long struggle ahead because it's clear that U.S. policy isn't ending. And the propaganda is the most dangerous that has been used nonstop here to suddenly make this reactionary grouping in Syria into democratic forces. And I think I've never seen such a heavy layer of nonstop social media blasts that were total fabrications, completely fake news.
Yes, in fact, one could say that the entire U.S. narrative of the Syrian conflict has been fake news.
Completely fake news. I just saw an excellent quote today. It was actually from a Greek publication, but quoting Malcolm X, and so appropriate here. If you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing. And that has been the role of powerful, financed, corporate financed forces in social media. By the sheer number of tweets, of Facebook pages, of petitions to call for U.S. intervention in an escalated form and to call for standing with these reactionary forces and hating the people who are being oppressed, which is the people of Syria, by this war. So this is the power of media, and it's the importance of standing up to it. I do want to really applaud what the Hands Off Syria Coalition has done over the past, I think, 2.5 weeks, where there have been 11 large major political meetings in defense of Syria and calling for U.S. Hands Off Syria, where Eva Bartlett was the main speaker. But from New York, New Haven, Washington, D.C., Boston, Detroit, Denver, all up and down the West Coast, also strong meetings. And meetings that were extremely informative, and at the same time putting forth demands for the U.S. to get out of Syria. That needs to increase. There needs to be mobilized support because there's been enormous silence and real disinformation coming from some parts of the left. Others have to take this on and stand for Syria and its right to exist as a sovereign country.
You're with the United National Anti-War Coalition, which is a part of the Hands Off Syria Coalition. Certainly, the United States is in need of a reinvigorated anti-war movement at this period in history. But what we're seeing is, especially coming from the Democratic Party, a renewed McCarthyism and anti-Russianism, which certainly doesn't create an environment for anti-war activity.
Actually, what's happening is incredible on the part of the Democratic Party. It's hard to have conceived on the election of Trump that you could find a way to attack him from the right. And yet that is what this claim, supposedly coming from the CIA, that this is all Russian interference in the U.S. election, is a way of doing, to distort the real opposition to Trump, which is there because he's a racist bigot in every form and there's forces behind him, and turn it on its head, turn it to the extreme right and try to use it as a force in a, whether it's called a new Cold War or just inflamed witch hunting and red baiting. Well, Russia's a capitalist country. I don't even mean red baiting, but any information at all, suddenly everyone from Snowden and WikiLeaks and the exposés of the DNC files, this is all, we're told, Russian propaganda, which is an absolute lie. there's even a struggle between different intelligence agencies, between the FBI and the CIA. How's that for the deep state supporting, endorsing, and being nefariously involved in both political parties, seeming that the CIA is in there doing what's helpful for the Democrats and the FBI, what's helpful for the Republicans, and both of them agencies whose only role is to lie. I mean, that's why they were created. That's a role of intelligence. And they're only two of 17 U.S. major intelligence agencies that are operating. So there's a lot of conscious fraud going on, a lot of thought of how to intervene and break up the movement, spread disinformation, create fake news, and also create phony issues. No longer at this point are the Democratic Party being charged for their own defeat, which was their determination to stick with a figure as hated, as rightfully hated, as Hillary Clinton. They're absolutely stepping on the opinions of the vast majority of the population and really supporting a war candidate, a war criminal. There are real reasons why there are lots of people who refuse to vote and refuse to be taken in by this. Instead, it's all become now suddenly a way to attack Russia and see if we can't build new war threats.
Yes, and isn't it amazing to see liberals and left liberals and folks who call themselves progressives and even radicals looking towards the CIA or the FBI as the arbiters of this so-called dispute about the election?
It's beyond foolishness. It's really criminal disinformation. But to be quoting the CIA and the FBI, it's out of step even with reality. Let's say these agencies were created to lie and spread disinformation. And not only to accept it, hook, line, and sinker, but to promote it. You look at the emails and mass campaigns coming out of MoveOn.org. It's to the right of Trump with its charges on Russia and refusing to deal with what was in any of these emails. To even discuss it now comes with a claim that you're some kind of Russian agent or this is Russian propaganda. So it's very convenient. This becomes a way of not dealing with what was exposed and revealed in all of those emails that suddenly surfaced.
So the Russianization of anything can taint truth, a reality, a source, a political tendency. Anything can be taken out of legitimate discussion simply by invoking Russians.
Absolutely. And it's being done consciously by the corporate media, where the Washington Post will promote and reprint whole lists of groups that are suddenly charged with promoting Russian propaganda. Outrageous. But of course, this means that they've long ago, any idea of freedom of the press isn't what they're about. They're about trying to promote a form of corporate stability in a system that no longer has any stability, and demanding everyone fall in line at a time when there's enormous disaffection. It won't succeed, but they have convinced themselves, just as they convinced themselves that Hillary Clinton would win for sure, that Trump couldn't possibly win. They're in for the same wake-up call in terms of, do they have the people in this country overwhelmingly believing their lies? There's a total disaffection going on. It's not yet mass activism, of course, by any means, not to be out of touch with reality on this, but their ability to hold on to the loyalty of millions of people, to be believed, that is what has slipped away from them totally. And no matter how much they claim it again and again, that's not what exists.
Yes, they seem to be further destabilizing their own system, deepening their own crisis of legitimacy with their dive into McCarthyism and their charges that their own institutions have somehow broken down or been infiltrated.
That's exactly. They're losing in every way. Of course, they're losing hold of their economy and their ability to dominate the world stage, using more and more threats at home and military threats abroad. That's what's all about. We're going to escalate nuclear capacity even greater than it was already upgraded to under the Obama administration. We saw the same thing in the pivot to Asia, which was the core of the Democratic policy to move 2/3 of the U.S. Navy and military into a surrounding of China and to vastly escalate the U.S. Navy from 278 ships up to 305. And then Trump campaigned, that wasn't enough. It had to be 350 ships, which is a huge, humongous escalation into ships that cost billions of dollars each. And then the Navy came back and said, no, we need 355 ships. This means nuclear submarines that in one launch could wipe out life on Earth. This means aircraft carriers, destroyers, a whole jet aircraft, electronic. A huge escalation is what is being planned. And why? It's because it means guaranteed profits and cost overruns to the largest military contractors, the largest corporations in the U.S. Not because, of course, it's in any way needed. Of course, it's not one of these only needed for the oppression of the world. But it robs every social program here. You wonder why there's no money for anything else. It's because it goes to subsidize a handful of corporations who must have that money, otherwise they will suffocate. They literally will shrivel. This is the impossible quandary that they're up against. They don't have a solution for it. But what I think the one confidence we should have going into a new year is that they're losing, their hold is slipping on the world and on the population here. And that's what we have to keep our eyes focused on, how more and more to consciously chip away at it, challenge every one of these lies and all of their fake news, and also take confidence when there's a big gain like there has just been in Syria in liberating Aleppo.
That was Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Tens of thousands of Haitians have held nearly daily demonstrations for more than a month, rejecting the results of their country's latest presidential election. Jovenel Moïse, a protege of former Haitian President Michel Sweet Mickey Martelly, who was installed 6 years ago, largely through the machinations of then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, is purported to have received 55% of the vote in a four-way race. All of the major Haitian parties charged the November election was rigged, just like every other Haitian election since the U.S.-backed coup in 2004. Daoud André is a Haitian community activist and radio program host based in Brooklyn, New York. He says nobody believes the U.S.-backed candidate won a majority of the vote.
Absolutely not. Jovenel Moïse is the individual that the United States understands will continue the legacy of Martelly, continue the plunder, the pillage that they've been doing in Haiti. And so nobody in the country knows who Jovenel Moïse is, Martelly, and the United States, because Martelly does not act alone, picked him out of a hat. So he's the one that they had put ahead the last time in 2015, and this was the reason why the people protested, because we did not want a continuation of Martelly. And this time again, with an avowed enemy of the people of Haiti, an avowed enemy of Lavalas. And when I say Lavalas, now I'm talking about not just in Lavalas as presently constituted Aristide's party, but everyone in the democratic movement who was at a certain time in 1990 Lavalas. Léopold Berlinguer is an enemy of us all, and he's the one who's the head of the Electoral Council. He's a former employee of USAID, the head of Vision 2000 radio station. It's a radio station owned by the, well, we don't call them 1% in Haiti, Glenn. We call them 0.01% in our country, the people who have all the money in the country. and who think that because of this, they can determine the fate of the entire nation. So he's the man who orchestrated this fraud together with the United States. And I'm happy to say that the people are in the streets, you know. Every day, I think there are up to 28 demonstrations since November 20th, when this fraud happened. And the people are not going to accept these results. And what we're saying to the United States is if they want Jovenel Moïse so bad as president, you know, they should put him in the White House in Washington. I'm sure, you know, he'll do fine for them over there.
These elections in November were themselves the result of negated elections, negated because of charges of voter rigging before. What is the regime and its global partners going to do? Just keep on scheduling elections and then the folks turn out and reject them and then schedule some more crooked elections?
You know, the thing is, they know what they want. And we know what we want, speaking like the people of Haiti. And we understand that they're not resting until they get what they want. And the people also are not resting until we get what we want. And so this is the ongoing battle. Sometimes, you know, when I'm speaking about Haiti, and, you know, the dozens of coups that have happened throughout our country, and people are saying that this is the problem with Haiti. This is not the problem with Haiti. I mean, we are a people who came out of resistance to a reality that we felt was unacceptable. And this is the history that we have. When we are in a situation that is unacceptable, we think it is ridiculous to wait 5 years and wait however long to allow the enemies to continue to drive us off a cliff. And so this is why throughout Haitian history you've had, it's a history of resistance, a history of turning things upside down, things, like I said, that are not acceptable. And this is the United States. Right now you have some people in the political class who, you know, intellectuals, people who, quote-unquote, middle class, who are saying, you know, let's accept this and, you know, we'll deal with it later. But why should we? Look at what happened in this 5 years that Martelly was imposed on the people. By the time the then-head of the Electoral Council, Pierre-Louis Aupon, came out publicly, said that Martelly was not the winner of the 2010 elections, hey, people were like, well, he's already here, so let's just let him finish his term. But in that time, he signed decrees giving control of our border to Israeli mercenary forces. He signed all kinds of agreements selling the land of the people on the offshore islands, Ila Vache, Lago Nav. He tried to make a completely separate entity out of Lago Nav, which is the biggest island off of Haiti's coast. And so they've created this scenario of Jovenel Moïse being some kind of planter, some kind of person who's interested in agriculture, which is a farce. He's just a clown, a puppet that they feel kind of looks like the masses of the people because he's a dark skin, you know, comes from peasant roots. But this is not who he identifies with. This is not the interests that he's defending right now. And so this is, we always say, not everyone who looks like you is you or is going where you're going. So this is why the resistance is continuing.
This time around, the people who count, miscount, or otherwise tabulate the votes in a four-way race gave Jovenel Moïse 55% of the vote and thereby avoided a runoff and awarded him a tally that approached the levels that were achieved by Jean-Bertrand Aristide during the actually free and fair elections before the coup.
You know, Glenn, last week we had an event in Brooklyn, Comocoda, Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti, to commemorate the 26th anniversary of this election that happened in 1990, where Jean-Bertrand Aristide, he got 67% of the vote. But that was out of 85% of the electorate. What you have right now is some clownish thing they're trying to do with what they're saying is about 21% of the electorate. Now, they did this fraud like this, and right now there's verification going on since the 20th of about 12% of the documents from each electoral vote center. And they had to do this fraud because it seemed clear going towards the end of that election process that were they to have a second round, like the different forces, I'll call them Lavalas forces, because Gilles Celestin is still within the Lavalas spirit. Maurice Jachal is a child of Lavalas. And Jean-Bertrand Aristide, that they would come together. And if you had these three forces come together, or at least two of them come together, like, it would be ridiculous to say that Jovenel Moïse won this election. But then again, I'm thinking about this. They probably would still do it, because if you can imagine Cité Soleil, which is the biggest slum in the country, this is a place that, I mean, people in this area, very poor part of outside Port-au-Prince, they live and breathe Lavalas, Aristide, I should say. And imagine that the results that they gave are saying that Jovenel Moïse defeated Aristide in Cité Soleil. So that means that there is no limit to what these people will do.
You sound like that's the equivalent of Trump carrying Bed-Stuy or Harlem.
Absolutely. That's what it means, basically. We understand this is the work of our enemies. Like, if you got that kind of result, you know, it would just seem like improbable, to say the least.
The last time we talked was before the U.S. election, and you were saying that Haitian Americans should vote for anybody except that thing called Hillary Clinton. Well, Hillary Clinton is not the president. What's your outlook?
You know, England, we said if it's a dog running against Hillary Clinton, we told our people they must vote for that dog. And when we said that, we had no idea it would have been a real dog, but it was. And so it really didn't matter to us. I mean, and we were not surprised. I have to tell you, Glenn, in September of 2015, Comocoda, that was the last time we held a protest at Hillary Clinton's headquarters in Brooklyn. And at that time, we brought the coffin, we did our little ceremony, and we said, this campaign is dead. It's a dead woman walking, basically. And I think it's funny that still right now, Clinton's, you know, the Democratic Party, Obama, the media, they're not getting over this. And they're talking about everything. Was it Umar Abedin? Was it like Comey? Was it Putin, you know, who did this? And they know it's not. But they're doing all of this because they cannot come out and say that Hillary Clinton was basically an unelectable candidate. Like, she was made Senator of New York fraud. You know, it was not on her own weight. It was given to her. A deal made her Secretary of State. It's something absolutely that she did not earn. I've read, like, every Secretary of State probably speaks another language, have some, you know, she didn't have any of this. This is deal cutting. And it's the same way they were trying to crown her Queen of the United States. And we said after the election, we put out a statement saying we were not surprised. And Michael Moore, he had put out this thing, and he said that although, you know, he was a liberal lapdog for Clinton, he was saying that Trump's victory will be the biggest F you ever recorded in human history, meaning that this is going to be the opportunity of regular folk in the United States to stick it to the establishment, to say that you are a farce, basically. I don't think it's so much that, just like us, I don't think that if the people of the United States had a real choice, they would have voted for Trump. But the establishment forced the situation. They forced the situation. They wanted someone that they thought could never beat anyone. So they got what appeared to be the stupidest, the most repugnant kind of individual they could find, you know, who was saying, like, Obama wasn't born here, like, you know, like garbage like this. And they said, yes, we've got our man, like, you know, Hillary has to defeat this clown. And then the people say, yeah, is that what you want, Hillary, that bad? Well, we're going to show you that we're going to vote this clown instead of Hillary Clinton. So this is what, for me, the election in the United States represents. What I think needs to happen right now, because I see like a lot of so-called progressives, a lot of the liberal white folks are crying for Hillary. They want Hillary, Glenn. Yes, silly people, you know. But I think that progressives should not take on Trump like from a defensive position. I think we have to go back to the militant movements of the 60s, the movements like right after Reconstruction, like movements for people over here to take their destiny in their own hands. In the statement we had put out right after election, we said that no black politician, no black organization should sit down with Trump until he apologizes to the Central Park Five. Because up to right the week before this election, this clown was saying these kids are guilty. And I don't see how we can have black people going and dealing with this man until you get through something like this. And to come to Trump like you're trying to sit with a reasonable person. No, I think that black people over here, progressives, have to deal with this moment like in the most radical fashion. The understanding that he says he's going to throw out tens of millions of undocumented folks. Our fight has to be right now for a general amnesty for all undocumented folk in this country. Yeah, we got Ronald Reagan, the other clown, to do it. So why we have to be afraid of that? We cannot be afraid to fight the way we should for the liberation of our political prisoners right now. And these have to be front and center in everything we're doing. Like, we cannot be afraid of a clown. I mean, these are paper tigers. This is what these people are. And they create this aura that tries to scare people. Like, he's having these generals. These are people who got their butt kicked by the Iraqis, you know, by the Taliban in Afghanistan. So this is like nothing to be afraid of. We think that we have to make a clear delineation between the position of these liberals run to Hillary Clinton, went to hide under her skirt. They were so scared of Donald Trump. And some of them, I have to say, they wanted to go there in the first place, you know. But this cannot be. We have to understand that progressives cannot stand with people like this. And even like with the Green Party, you know, that the position that Jill Stein took to go take this recount thing to benefit Hillary Clinton, I mean, there has to be principled criticism too. So it's clear that this is part of the reason why large segments of black people, of real progressives, understand that we cannot trust you if you're doing something like this. You cannot be speaking one way, and then when the rubber meets the road, you go stand with something on the side of this position. We have to fight Trump head on, not try to go to the Democratic Party, these people we know are our enemies, to tell them, okay, we're going to support you so you can lead our fight. I think the moment is for radical opposition, radical, not just resistance, but radical attack on this garbage. I think police forces all over the country must be feeling emboldened right now. But just as they are feeling this, we have to step it up in a way that, you know, we give them no quarter. And so this is the position that we are calling for, that nobody should be afraid of these paper tigers, of these clowns, that the streets we live on, the communities that we occupy, that we own this, not them.
That was Haitian community activist Daoud André speaking from Brooklyn, New York.
The clock is ticking away. The remaining days of Barack Obama's time in the White House. Counterpunch radio host Eric Dreitzer invited two of Barr's favorite people to discuss the Obama presidency. Pascal Robert is a frequent contributor to Black Agenda Report. Yvette Cornell hosts the influential website Breaking Brown. She spoke first.
Well, when I look back on these 8 years, the one thing that stands out the most for me is that the privileged people in this country are doing better than ever. You know, Obama was supposed to come in and be the president of hope. He came in under change we can't believe in hope. And now I think we're in a post-hope era. I think that's where we are. You know, the median income is still well below where it was in 2007 for Americans. And people just don't understand that. So when I look at it, I look at if, you know, we had a shot. I thought of Obama. The reason I voted for Obama, even given what I knew about him and questions that other people had raised, we had one shot to kind of get this guy in here who wasn't like the other presidents. This was a Black guy. You know, he came from his mother was a single mom, as we've been told. And what he did, he kind of pulled the rug out from up under us. He saved the financial industry and didn't do anything for Main Street except decimate us. So I don't even think of Obama. People say Obama did a little bit. Well, Obama did a little. I think Obama neutralized working people's politics, especially Black politics, and left us far worse off than we were before he came.
Tough to disagree with that. Pascal, your take on Obama these last 8 years and just what's percolating in your mind as we look back on all of this?
Well, the way Obama figures in my mind is that basically he did the job that he was manufactured to do. Barack Obama was a creature of Wall Street and finance capital from the beginning. There's a great video of him you can find on YouTube at the Hamilton Group initial meeting. He was the only U.S. senator there, and he's basically genuflecting to the Robert Rubin agenda. He was close friends with Michael Froman, who was his law school buddy, fellow Law Review, Harvard Law Review, a student as well, who Michael Froman was good friends with Bob Rubin's son, Robert Rubin, of course, former Secretary of Treasury under Bill Clinton, one of the most nefarious Secretary of Treasuries we've ever had, who was a chief head of the deregulation that led to the subprime mortgage crisis. So these are the people that basically are in Obama's ear in 2005, 2006, even before he becomes president, considering that he received more Wall Street financing than any president we had in American history at that time in 2008, considering also he got more money from the oil lobby than any president in the prior 20 years, including Republicans. So when have you ever heard of Democrats out fundraising with the energy industry, Republicans, particularly those going back 20 years before him? So what we have to understand is that Barack Obama was basically a manufactured creature of Wall Street from the beginning. WikiLeaks has already exposed that same Citigroup executive, Michael Froman, chose his whole cabinet. So in that consideration, the fact that he came in, you know, protected the banks, executed the TARP, allowed them to run amok. Quantitative easing has basically been pouring money into the economy to the detriment of the working class support and the middle class in this country. No major jobs bill in 8 years for a man who came in and had complete control of the Senate and the House, had expended no political capital using the bully pulpit to push a jobs agenda at all, any time in his presidency. His greatest legacy thus far is Obamacare, which as of this month is going up 22% to 24% in its premiums and is already shown to be problematic because it has no cost controls. So what we see in Obama is basically neoliberalism in blackface, fired more teachers of color than any president in American history, charterized education all over the country, highest number of public schools closed all over the country, record numbers of poverty rates in the United States during the Obama administration that only recently started to decrease, highest black child poverty rate in 40 years, up to 37%. For me, Barack Obama was not only a disaster for African Americans, he was a disaster for the working class and the poor, while the Dow went almost over 19,000. So in terms of what he did, he was the creature of the individuals that created him, which again was the financial sector. As a Rubenite, he is an acolyte of Robert Rubin, who totally cannibalized this economy with his deregulation. So we got what we didn't know we paid for, but what we really did, which is basically a man who came into office to pimp out a civil rights black struggle legacy to be a complete tool of the financial service industry that had historically gutted the black community anyway, and do so with a smiling face, charming wife, and a good jump shot. That's basically what we got in Barack Obama.
Well, and I want to follow up with that before I go back to Yvette. Pascal, I want to ask this question, though. Everything you said is, of course, true. But what I would like to know is, do you think that Obama was the one that they needed to be able to get away with all of those things? In other words, could a cut and dried, you know, a cookie cutter white Democrat or white Republican have ever gotten away with all of those things?
I have been saying for quite a long time that Barack Obama was the biggest gift to the ruling class and power elite than any president in recent history. Because what Barack Obama did is that he used his exotic racial narrative. You know, I'm biracial, my mom was white, my dad was African, I've got this really beautiful African-American wife, I grew up in Hawaii and Indonesia, I'm post-racial, multiracial, some racial, racial today, racial tomorrow, not racial yesterday. I mean, this kind of amorphous, very exotic racial narrative, not only do I think is important to selling this pitch, what it does, and this is what's particularly about Obama, if you ever notice Obama talk about his presidency, he always talks about how himself and what he can bring in terms of bringing people together. For example, you read Ta-Nehisi Coates' speech with that pablum that he wrote, "My President Was Black." It is always focused on how Obama's particular type of blackness, his multiracial blackness, his growing up with Midwestern Kansas parents, gives him this ability to kind of be like the biracial whisperer into the hearts of white folk, because they'll feel safer with him, which I think is a load of garbage. What it really is that basically there is an assumed progressiveness that comes along with his racial narrative that makes it hard to believe that this charming black man with a brown wife is a Wall Street pimp, that he's basically a pawn of the financial services industry that completely gutted the America overall, and particularly African Americans. So what happens is that this kind of smooth, charming, kind of caramel figure walks into your house, and you don't want to believe, no, he's not a bad guy. Come on, that's Barry. We know him from back in the day. He's a wonderful guy. And of course, it works perfectly to neutralize the sensibilities, particularly of the left and liberals, who normally would have questioned policies. I mean, it's very simple. What happened to the anti-war movement under Obama? It disappeared.
That's right.
It's gone. Why is it gone? Because not only is it that he's a Democrat, it's because the charming narrative of having this black face in a high place, being able to possibly drop drones on Somali children, escapes the consciousness of most Americans because they don't see it as possible.
That was Pascal Robert, preceded by Yvette Cornell on Counterpunch Radio. Tensions were high last week in Milwaukee, where police disrupted a community feed-in event organized by a chapter of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party. Black parents say the cops struck a 10-year-old girl in the face. Dr. Ali Muhammad, the chief general commander of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party, says the cops in Milwaukee were angry over an armed demonstration by the party a week before.
On December the 17th, 2016, we did an African Holocaust Human Rights Tribunal in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the African Holocaust Museum there. the Milwaukee Historical Society. We did an African Human Rights Tribunal for the Black African Holocaust. The cases in particular in Milwaukee was Savell Smith, who was a young brother, who was murdered and gunned down savagely, which we actually have documented as genocide and a crime against humanity. Jay Anderson, who was another brother, he was in his vehicle and he was gunned down, shot 14 times. Also, Dontre Hamilton, as well as brother Corey Stingley, who was a 16-year-old brother who was in a store. And three white males choked him to death on the ground because they told him to leave the store. And these three white men walked. And so him, these particular cases were a major part of the Human Rights Tribunal we did there, but also the poverty, the actual poor education, unemployment, all of those issues that are genocide and human rights, crimes against humanity was also a part of this tribunal. Of course, the local media was present there. And then on Sunday, December 18, we did an armed Black Human Rights March against terrorism and genocide for the victims of police terror and genocide carried out by law enforcement officers in the United States of America. And that was a very big thing that went viral on social media. Different police agencies were actually writing threats on their own pages. Like it's this one called the Blue Shield or Blue Wall, something like that. And they were talking about, you know, all they need is one RPG. If they had an RPG, they would have shot it at us while we were out there marching on. But we were strong, you know, very strong. And every statement that we made, we met.
Let me interrupt. Is Wisconsin a carry state?
Yeah, it is an open carry state. Yes, it is. Also, some of the statements that we made, you know, went to a whole different dynamic because we said, you know, fuck Donald Trump. We talked about, and we have a saying in the party. Some people are confused about what it means when we say it, but we say free us or you die cracker. So they cut the free us part out and just put the die cracker part there. And there's a lot of different things they did, but they felt intimidated because a lot of the white citizenry of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin was like, oh, where were the police? Why did you let them do that? This is right in our backyard and all this other stuff they were saying and doing. And so the first day after that march, which was Monday, December 19th, at our food program, there was a large police presence there then. And they even had snipers on the roof. They can be seen on the roof just at a food program. But it was just so overwhelming love by the people. Like you said, like hundreds of people in the community came out that they didn't do anything or try anything there. But the night of the armed march, one of our sergeants in the party who was in uniform, she went to a gas station and she was robbed at gunpoint for her vehicle. And, you know, it just seemed like it could be something random, but the people, everybody in the community knows us, and these were new faces that did this. Then at that same food program, because, you know, we travel armed and we also serve armed. So, you know, there's rifles or shotguns and pistols we have when we do our programs as well. So the vehicle comes up, rolls up to the program, the police, because the police, one part of the area, they had their cars lined up like they were blocking people from exiting. And so I did instruct them when they called me about it, the generals on the ground, to let them know there's no reason to have a perimeter set up. So they're like, no, no, that's not what they're doing. So they kind of cleared it at one point. They backed their cars up to allow this vehicle to come in. This vehicle rode in, and it was like, Black Power, Black Power, the same ones that stole the car, in the car. And so one of the MODs pulled out his pistol. And so it was a good thing that the general was there and told him, you know, like, to not point it at the vehicle, because it seemed like they were trying to incite us to respond to this theft that happened. And so the general went to the car himself. He banged on the glass because, again, really emotionally responded to the situation. The car veered back real fast. The police opened way again and let them out. They let them in, let them out. And then somebody said loudly a couple of times, that's a stolen car. The car's stolen. And not only did they veer out, but there was like something that the police put up next to a police van that was out there. And they even slightly bumped into the police van and still, you know, veered out and the police were just right there. So for us, that was a setup too. So going from there until now. So yesterday at our food program, about 40 police officers show up. They had a tactical unit out there with AR-15s and basically about 40 police officers. They came to the food program, and it's a food program. Now, they're not going to come up with us out there marching and gunning in war posture, but they come to a peaceful food program with elders and children from the community there as well. And they came there, and they ended up assaulting a 10-year-old girl. They hit her in her mouth. They ended up with a firearm from one of the members of the party. But how they did it, how the story goes to me, is that she was putting the firearm up because it was at the end of the food program, and they snuck up on her from behind and took it sort of from the vehicle. So it was a shotgun. And then altercation happened, and basically at the end of that, one member ended up going to jail, and that was because it was alleged that he had some type of warrant, they said. He was the only one that went to jail, but they assaulted the program. They came with their intimidation tactics, harassing people. And again, they had a tactical unit out there, a food program.
And how do they explain the assault on the 10-year-old girl, or do they admit that that happened?
They were quiet. They wouldn't respond to it, not on the ground, but the parents of the child did follow up, and they identified who the officer was who did it. There's no way for them to explain that. Basically, this is like the first time since like the 1960s that they've actually attacked the Black Panther Party food program. You know, this, it reminds me of that whole particular thing. And in essence, there's so many other things that they could actually go after, but they come and attack the pantry. It also appears that as if they're trying to intimidate the people, you know, trying to make the people afraid to support us, you know, in that particular way as well.
How long has the party been doing this People's Public Pantry and Feed the People program, and what kind of history has it had with the police?
We haven't had any altercations prior to our armed march and prior to the Human Rights Tribunal, because the Human Rights Tribunal charges the state of Wisconsin and the city of Milwaukee with genocide, and the law enforcement there in that area as well, and the political establishment as well. So prior to that, we haven't had any altercations. We've been doing this for over a year now. We'll be following up with all action that we can from a human rights dynamic and whatever other litigation factors that we will do. And also to let them know that we will not be intimidated, that we always are supposed to be ready, but we will be prepared for any type of activity they come with like that again. At a peaceful food program, even though, you know, we do all of our activities on, it was really like an element of surprise for those who were on the ground. And of course, I was not there. That's one of our local chapters. But the point is that it won't happen again the way that they want it to happen.
And where does the party have chapters?
We have chapters throughout the country. We have about 40 chapters nationwide. Our most effective chapters are in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Los Angeles, California, also Bridgeport, Connecticut. But we have chapters all over Atlanta, Georgia, Tallahassee, Florida, Miami, Florida. We have two chapters in Central Florida. We have chapters in Las Vegas, Nevada. We have a chapter in Dallas, Texas, Houston, Texas. Our actual headquarters is in Jackson, Mississippi. We have chapters in North Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Our next Human Rights Tribunal in armed action will be in Wilmington, North Carolina on the weekend of January the 28th. This is in reference to the cases in particular that we'll be covering, of course, would be Brother Keith Lamont Scott, and also it's a brother by the name of Brandon Smith who was assassinated, a victim of genocide there by law enforcement. But at this particular point in time, I do have the Revolutionary Black Panther Party National Sister. This is General Amina.
Sister Amina, General Amina, you were on the scene in this latest conflict with the police.
It reminded me, like she said, of the 1960s when they attacked the Panther Food Program. And you can tell it was a target because of the march we had prior to that. And to see that when we stand as one against genocide of our people, then it seems like they tried to send a message out saying that even though we try to stand no matter what, we will try to come in and demolish anything that we can because of the energy and what we're trying to achieve. It was something that was unexpected because it never happens. As many times as we all do the food programs, the breakfast programs, we never had an incident like that. And for the police to come in and to make a scene like that and mess everything up and try to make conflict and just try to drive us out, it wasn't a good feeling at all. But us being strong African people, we knew how to handle the situation. And power of the Creator was behind us 100%. I think that this experience will be an eye-opener for all of us to further protect ourselves and just continue to do what we need to do, feed, clothe, shelter, and defend our people.
That was Dr. Ali Muhammad of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party.
The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, a former member of the original Black Panther Party, has a New Year's message from Prison Radio. It's about the magic of black music.
As the deaths of two musicians recently demonstrates, black music is an art form that radiates freedom, and that radiation flows around the world. The death of Sharon Jones, lead singer for the Dap Kings, is of course tragic in that she died of cancer at a relatively young age of 60. Yet her very being was a celebration of a stellar life force. A woman once told she was too black, too short, and too fat to become a performer, did just that, and thrilled the hearts, ears, and souls of millions. In their horn-heavy, down-home standard, 100 Days, 100 Nights, Sharon Jones sings a lesson learned of a lover, a hard lesson, to pay attention to whom you lend your heart. Her determination led her to ignore agents and record producers and allowed her to set the stage afire with her blazing spirit. She freed herself and those she blessed with her voice and her powerful dark presence. Across the Atlantic, a Brit of Greek parentage did his own share of lighting the stage afire. Born Georgios Panayiotou in 1963 in East Finchley, North London, England, he became world famous as George Michael of Wham. Like many young Brits of his generation, simply read Boy George, for example, the beats, rhythms, and blues of black music struck their ears and moved them. These artists, raised on Motown sounds, constructed musics based on that dark ore and found fame and fortune. I think what they heard and what they found in black music was precisely what black musicians seeded it with, a yearning for freedom. For it was in the magical realm of music that black folks found their closest vision of freedom, to be, to become themselves. That energy was infectious and touched hearts and souls worldwide. Jazz soars in France, in Poland, in Japan. Rap has a deep foothold in London, in Paris, in Tokyo, in Soweto, in Harare, in Berlin, in Marseille, in every city where there are those who are oppressed. George Michael mixed black beats to fuel his pop hits and often used black producers and black musicians to enrich his work. When he came out as gay, he may have shocked the media, but it could be sensed in the subtexts of his songs and felt in his frenetic beats. Black musical beats and rhythms liberated him, freed him to be his self, because in black music, one finds that yearning for freedom.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.